Welcome into the Original Gangsters News Network and Podcast. I am your host, Scott Bernstein, and we are about to embark on a journey into the belly of the beast when it comes to the New England underworld, the Boston underworld, the Irish mob. I am pumped. I am stoked to bring on a fellow true crime author, Springs Toledo, one of the best in the business out in New England. Nobody chronicles the history of the Boston underworld better than Springs, and he has delivered a masterpiece in his new book called Don't Talk About Joe Mack. It's a deep dive into the legendary Boston Irish mobster Joe McDonald, one of the founders of the Winter Hill Gang. And this is the best OC book I've read in two decades. I'm in love with it. It was riveting. Springs, thank you so much for coming on the show and chopping it up with us.
That was quite the introduction. I appreciate it very much.
My God, was that I imagine this was a labor of love, because it comes out in the narrative that you craft. And for me, I've talked to you a couple times off camera, and I said I knew who Joe Mack was. I mean, anybody that has studied, the gangland orbit, the compelling Shakespearean gangland orbit that is New England and Boston, but I guess I didn't have the appreciation for the mythic status of Joe Mack. I think he's somebody, you know, Whitey gets all the pub nationally, but I think this showed me that, like, within Southie, within Somerville, Joe Mack's reputation far exceeds Whitey's and has this epic mythology that echoes almost 30 years after he passed.
Well, it echoes very quietly. Because
don't talk about it.
Exactly. Yeah. And here we are talking about him. But luckily for us, he's safely dead. Somebody asked me if I interviewed Joe McDonald for the book. And I said, if I interviewed Joe McDonald for the book, I wouldn't have walked out of that room.
Right.
There's no doubt about it. You just didn't mention his name. And that's why he is basically a footnote or gets barely a mention in most of the books that are out there about the Boston Underworld and the Winter Hill Gang. It wasn't until Howie Carr published Hitman and Bobby Martini did Citizen Somerville that he started to get a little bit of notoriety. But for John Martorano mentioning his name, and he did not mention his name in terms of the Roger Wheeler murder until Joe was dead. You just didn't talk about him. And that's how he preferred it. As a matter of fact, a lot of his hits were attributed to other guys. Barboza, who I'm sure you know about.
Yeah, Joe the Animal.
Exactly. Flemmy took some of his hits. A lot of guys, Martorano, claimed to have done the hits that Joe did. And even while he was alive, he would not have disputed that. He didn't mind. He wanted to be quiet. He was really kind of an old school mentality like that. He was the anti-Gotti. He did not want publicity. He didn't want a thing. He wanted to be in the shadows. And that's why, you know, he did 41 murders. And that, I think that number is solid. And I believe it, based on who I got it from. And he never got indicted. I think he might've been questioned for one. It was a killing of a federal witness out in Sierra Madre, but otherwise never indicted. That's an accomplishment because, you know, crime doesn't necessarily pay in the end. And he lived a tough life, but he really did it the way you're supposed to do it.
He lived a very accomplished life. And I say this, you know, with respect to his victims and their families, accomplished in his field of choice, which was being a gangster. He was somebody that everybody feared. Everybody looked at him as very capable in everything that he did. But I think what was, when I say accomplished, what was most One of the things that was most fascinating to me was learning about his military service in World War II, and learning about his Golden Gloves boxing title when he was younger. I mean, this is a guy that was more than just a killer.
He, well, you know, it's very interesting because he could have been something special in the legitimate world. You know, I mean, he's a murderer. So, we, you know, I can't give him too much.
He was stone cold. He was stone cold, man. Cold blooded.
He was. He was very effective, but he had a brilliant mind, and he had a very strong will. And he was not the psychopath that at least one book depicted him as. That he was not. He was a professional. He did it if it had to be done in that world. And I'll be honest, there's one guy who we killed, John Robichaud. That was belated. That guy was in Boston underworld parlance, John Robichaud was what we called a savage. Barboza was another one, a savage. Mm-hmm. And so when Joe put him down, interestingly enough, not only did he get to him, which is very difficult to do, but he left the body across the Fellsway in Somerville. Across the street from where the body was the Somerville District Court. That, the way I framed it, is that's a rebuke to the criminal justice system. This man was escaping from prison. This man was let loose early, twice. You know, the criminal justice system failed, and he was an absolute killer. I mean, he didn't care who he killed. That was a psychopath. And Joe got to him. And the fact that he brought the body to place it where he did means he had a little bit of a sense of humor and a sense of, I'm almost hesitant to say righteousness, because that guy had to go. The guy was very, very dangerous.
Some poetic, gangland poetic justice.
Right, right. Yeah. And yeah, so that was that the name of that title was The Man Who Wouldn't Die. And a matter of fact, I wrote that chapter with John Carpenter's Halloween theme playing on a loop.
Some inspiration.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to cut, you know, normally I like to do my interviews kind of chronologically, if we're talking about, you know, doing kind of a bio. But I think that this should be the exception, because not only, so we're going to cut right to the chase, and then we're going to kind of go backwards a little bit and talk a little bit about his history. But first, I want to talk about the biggest piece of breaking news, or the, you know, what should be the headline in terms of selling this book or pitching this book to an audience. It's not just this unbelievable biography of this utterly fascinating criminal. You also are able to put to bed, solve one of the great mysteries of the New England underworld over the last, let's say, half century. And we have, because of your book, we can now definitively say what happened to Jimmy Sims, who was, like Joe Mack, one of the kind of founding members of Winter Hill, was Joe Mack's longtime partner in crime. And now Jimmy Sims disappeared in 1992. Nobody knew whatever happened to him. And now your book comes out and we know exactly what happened to him. And it's like something out of a movie. Break it down. Let everybody know what happened to Jimmy Sims and how it happened and who was responsible for it. Wink, wink, or spoiler alert, it was Joe Mack.
Right. Well, you know, it's a fascinating story. And going into the project, I started 2019 is when I started looking into whether this was going to be a book or not. And I knew from the beginning that I would have to get to the bottom of the Jimmy Sims mystery, or else what am I doing? They were best friends. Joe Mack loved Jimmy Sims. Jimmy Sims loved Joe Mack. They were very, very, they were close partners. They had a great mutual respect. Jimmy Sims himself was damn near the professional that Joe Mack was. His whole life's a mystery. Matter of fact, even his partners thought he was an orphan. So I had to get to that, too. But in terms of his disappearance, most of the books say that he disappeared in 1987. And nobody knows what happened. And I believe them, because I talked to many of the Winter Hill partners who are still with us. And they had no idea. One of them, John Martirano, he said, if you find out what happened to Jimmy Sims, please let me know, because I always wanted to know what happened there. And I told him, I said, it's a long shot, but I'll go down swinging. A little aside. I'm a Catholic, practicing Catholic. When I got confirmation, I took the name Anthony. Anthony's the patron saint of the lost. I talked to Saint Anthony, and I think he's the reason how I found that, you know, I found out not only what happened to Jimmy Sims, but who got him, where they got him, how they got him, why they got him, and where the body is.
Right.
Now, in order
it's pretty,
to do that,
it's pretty fucking amazing, man. It really is. I don't mean to be just continually throwing you flowers, but it's really amazing. And I apologize if I said he disappeared in 92. I guess he was killed in 92, but nobody knew where he was from the late 80s onward.
Oh, no, no. You got it right. You got it right. The books say that he disappeared in 87. He didn't. They just had that wrong. He was in the late, early 90s. He was in outside of Boston, South Boston, near Quincy. That's where he's living. And then in around 92, he moved to Dorchester. But he was around. He was just doing his own thing. And that, I think that was just some confusion with the years. But no, he disappeared in 92. So what happened was, in order to find out what happened, what I had realized is that Joe Mack, part of his success story, part of his rationale was to compartmentalize everything. So, you know, the partners knew so much about him or what he was doing. His family, who he used as confidants, they knew a little bit of what, maybe a little more of what he was doing. You had guys in the lower end of South Boston he worked with. They knew some stuff he was doing. Then you had Sims. So he compartmentalized. So it's very difficult to get to the bottom of what happened to Sims because everybody had a piece. So I had to get to the right people at the right time, convince them to talk to me, and then get their information and then piece it together. The key was an individual who I know knew I was told knew what happened. He wouldn't even talk for 2 years. He wouldn't even say he never would say Joe's name, wouldn't even say his name. So he was the key. And then there was Jackie Mansfield. He's a guy in Charlestown. Very good man. He was an iron worker. He was best friends with Joe and Sims. And so little by little, I get information. The first really interesting piece of information I got was from a guy in Southie. He said that Joe took an ad out of the Boston Herald looking for Jimmy Sims. So I said an ad. Now, I didn't know that Joe killed him. A lot of guys are saying Joe would never have done that. Joe put loyalty above all things. He's not going to kill his friend. He was not about that. Other guy says, yeah, he killed him over money. That didn't sound right. Other guy says he didn't kill him at all. He went on the lam. Matter of fact, Jackie Mansfield, best friend of both of them, he said he went on the lam. He owed a lot of money to a lot of people, particularly the five families, or at least one of them. And so he disappeared. He was really good at disappearing. So I was moving in that direction. But once I found out about the ad, I tracked it down. I found now the Herald's not online. You can't get to the Herald online, the old issues, old editions. So that was tough. So I had to go to the Boston Public Library and sit there for who knows how long. But I finally got the damn ad. He ran it. Joe Mack ran it for 10 days. And then months later, I'm talking to Joe's great nephew, and he had a notebook handwritten by Joe. He didn't know it was Joe's writing. He was just using it for gym stuff. But I noticed, I was like, this is his writing. I could tell from the military records of writing MASH. And what he said, he had an entry that said, ask about taking an ad out to find him. He didn't name him, which is a little bit of a hint right there. He didn't name him.
Right.
So
right.
That got interesting. And then the guy, and then I found out from the guy in Charlestown that he was the last one to see Jimmy Sims because they were sitting there watching the Super Bowl together in January of 1992. Now, Sims was a degenerate gambler. Joe shut him down in probably Boston, definitely in Southie, and in Somerville, and among the partners. He owed so many people so much money, and he couldn't help himself. You know, the next bet's going to be the big win.
And nobody's taking his money. Nobody's taking his act.
Nobody's taken because of Joe. They would have because Sims was a very intimidating guy, very intimidating guy. Happy-go-lucky guy, but very dangerous. People would have, but Joe says, no, that's it. He owes too many people money. So what does he do? He goes to New York. How do I know this? Well, the guy who watched the Super Bowl with him, he knew. And he said that he put everything on that game and he lost. And he turned white as a sheet. And the guy was watching him. And then he just left and he almost left rudely. He was upset. And then that was it. He never saw him again.
And was just to give people some information on that Super Bowl, that was Washington versus Buffalo.
Yeah, what Redskins Bills, yep.
And Redskins won, I think, pretty convincingly.
And he lost big. And he was very good. I mean, he understood football like nobody's business. And he knew how to bet. He used to run the football cards and all that from the early set, probably the late 60s, right on through. So he knew his game. But he just, you know, he got the fever and the fever overtook him. So he lost. And now he owes money to guys in New York, big money. And what Jackie Mansfield believed is that he placed a lot of bets on a lot of people. So he was going all over the place. There's no way he's going to pay it back. He already has a reputation. So he goes in hiding. Nobody knows where he is. Joe calls Jackie Mansfield. Where is he? Have you heard from him? If you hear from him, I don't care if it's 3 a.m, call me and let me know. And I believe at first that was a friend who's wondering about what happened to, you know, to Jimmy Sims. So he put the word out. But then I found out, and this was quite accidental, New York came looking for Jimmy Sims. They went to Jackie. And if they went to Jackie, they went to Joe. And suddenly now, Joe's now frantically looking for him. But a letter came. Jimmy Sims wrote a letter to Jackie Mansfield and to Joe Mack. The letter does not exist anymore. You know, it would have been great if I, you know, had it in laminated or something like that, but it doesn't exist anymore, neither one of them. But it did say, in essence, that don't look for me. You know, I had to go. And, you know, everything's okay, but don't look for me. So Jackie says that that after that, Joe kept looking for him. Joe kept looking for him. Then the ad came out. So eventually, long story short, he smoked him out. And what he said was that now it wasn't just the letter in the ad in the Boston Herald. He also was at the Lowell Golden Gloves asking for Jimmy Sims. And he was told to, if anybody sees him or can get word to him, tell him that I have something for him or I have money for him. He's trying to smoke him out. So eventually he did. Then I got really lucky. I talked to a guy who knew what happened. He didn't tell me he was there. He didn't tell me how he knew, but he finally agreed after 2 years to talk to me. But even then, he didn't talk to me. What he did is he slid. I met him in a diner up in north of Boston. You know, he's looking around like this. He's got a fedora on. So I sit down. First thing I do is I thank him. And he says, yeah, I got this piece of paper. He says, yeah, I got some information on it, but I'm not sure what it means. And he slides it over. It's like a puzzle. It's like names. There's Joe's name. There's Sim's name. You know, there's numbers. So then it became a dance because I can't ask him questions. You can't ask these guys questions. They're not going to answer. They can't feel like a snitch. But so he's expecting me to take that sheet of paper and to go on my merry way. I can't do that because I don't know what the hell it means. I got a little bit of an idea, but I don't know what it means. So what I decided to do is I'm going to make statements as to what I think each part means, and then I'm going to look at them. So that's what I did. One item said 11/1/1/5. I said, yeah, that's 11/15. That's November 15th. Looks like Sims went on November 15th and he just looked away. And I said, looks like 11/15 at night. He said, could be. So what I realized is that over time, little trial and error, anything that wasn't looking away meant yes. If he looked away, it meant no. If anything else meant yes. So I was able to tease information out of him in a way that he could preserve his reputation as never talking and never snitching. And I found out that what happened was he went at 11:15 at night. It was in Quincy because it said Quincy right there. And there was a car and then it was not a car, meaning Jimmy Sims was picked up, driven to the site. By the time he got to the site, meaning the burial site, he's gone. He's dead. And he's in Quincy. So then, so I took it, the information I got. Oh, and he was shot in the head once. No, excuse me, twice. So then I took the sheet, and there's another guy. And this guy's an underworld figure who's in the know. And I wanted to see what he thought of the sheet. So I got permission from the first guy. And I said, you know, can I take it to this guy? He says, yeah. I said, then I'm going to burn it. So I take it to the guy, and the guy looked at it. And then he looked at me. And it was like, it was an, oh my God, kind of a moment. And he said, this is everything. This is exactly what happened. So then me being the nut that I am, I go to, he said, oh, let me back up a little. I said, Quincy, there are quarries in Quincy. And everybody believes that a lot of bodies are at the bottom of the quarry. It's like a pond. I said, the quarry, right? Is that where it is? And Quincy, he says, no. He said there was a mob graveyard off of Fennel Street. I never even heard of that. He says you wouldn't have. He said only the heavy hitters knew it. He did not include Whitey Bulger. The heavy hitters of the 1310, the lower end of Salty, and guys like Joe Mack. That's the three he named. This place is near a marshland. It's a patch of woods off a residential street, and it's kind of a marshland, which means that in the dead of winter, you can dig and you can bury. You know, you can put a body out there. He said there are a lot of bodies out there, and that's where he is. So, yeah. So I went out there early in the morning on basically not the anniversary of when they got him, because I don't know exactly the date that they got him. But I went out there in 2002. This happened in 92, and I'm walking around there in the dead of night like a nut. Just kind of trying to get the feel, and it's an ideal place. There's a trail going through there to a graveyard. The graveyard happens to be an old naval graveyard from way back. And there's little side trails that you could take off the beaten path. So there's patches everywhere. It looked like plots. And the guy told me those are plots. There were bodies in there. They use lime and everything else to get, you know, to help them decompose. But so that's basically the story. But then I'm leaving. This is the best part for me. As I'm driving out of there, I'm driving up Fennel Street. I look up and the sign says Sims Road. I said, okay, right.
Wow. What is your communication like with authorities? Are they looking to possibly dig over there?
I don't know. I don't think so. I did talk to a lot of federal agents, DEA agents, retired, most of them, police officers, detectives in three states. But I wasn't volunteering that kind of stuff because I'd be careful with getting this information. You know, first of all, the guys that I talked to have never spoken before. They don't talk. And that's a difference with my book, in that most of the other books, their sources are cooperating witnesses, guys testifying for the government. Now, what they'll have you believe, these sources or these cooperating witnesses, is that they were telling the story. My retort is, you're telling their story, meaning the government's. That's what this is. I was able to get the guys who are in the know, but who never talked, who did their time quietly, sometimes a lot of it, and they talked to me. Well, why did that happen? Am I that charming? No. Number one is, I'm a Boston guy, so the accent helps. Number two is, I know guys who know guys if I don't know them myself. So I was able to get intermediaries, and they would introduce me to guys who never talked before, these very serious individuals, many of them. And then they would sit down with me because I was vouched for. And thirdly was the timing. These guys are, you know, these guys are getting up there in age now, and they're all Catholics. So they're facing judgment and they want to get things off their chest. So I was kind of the right guy at the right time. So those three reasons, I think especially probably my Boston roots that got me in their presence and made them comfortable talking to me. I also had to be very careful with, you know, I wouldn't even venture to say, can I tape this conversation? You don't do that.
Right.
I don't want to write anything down. So if I'm talking to one guy, I'm just trying to remember. Then I go in my car, then I write things down. But a couple times I had to, because these guys had a lot to say. But what I would do is I would have the notebook on the chair beside me. And I would tell them, like, listen, I'm going to take notes. You know, but if there's anything that you don't want in it, I'll respect that, which is not what a journalist is supposed to do. I don't give a damn. I'm the killer.
It's different when you're a lot of the journalistic parameters and protocols, frankly, get thrown out the window when you're in what we do. Just you're not going to get information from people. You're not going to get people to feel comfortable with you if you go by what the traditional, the quote unquote book tells you to do.
Exactly. Yeah. So I knew that instinctively from the beginning. So if I did have to take notes, I would not have it on the table in front of me so they can see it. It's going to make people uncomfortable from the chair. And I'm looking at them and then I'm just writing just, you know, freehand, you know, on the side. And then afterwards I say, you know, you're free to look at the notes if you want. You know, I would do that. They never took me up on that because what I'm showing is that you can trust me. I'm offering this to you. And that was enough. So I think that made guys comfortable. And not to mention the fact that if they said off the record, it was off the record. I'm not going to put it in. And if there was something that they said that could put them in jeopardy, I'm not going to hurt guys that help me. So, and I told him that, I said, I'm looking for the truth of Joe Mack. I said, what this means is that I need to tell the truth of him, but I'm not going to hurt anybody. But when it comes to things that might be uncomfortable, when it comes to the story, I have to honor that, because Joe Mack was very adamant about being honest, believe it or not. I mean, he's a thief and a racketeer and a killer and everything else, but he did not like liars. If he caught you lying to him twice, he walked away and never spoke to you again. So I told him, I said, you know, in order to write this book, I have to tell the truth of it. So keep that in mind. And they did. They knew him. So they said, yeah, that's what he was like.
So I want to just drill down on one or two more spots in this this breaking news aspect of your book. In terms of Joe Mack, and again, I want, because context matters and timelines matter. And please correct me if I'm inaccurate in putting this forward. Joe Mack in 1992 was at the end of his life. He only lived another 5 years. And he was not an active gangster at that point. He was kind of in gangster retirement, running a boxing gym with some money that he got off of Whitey when he came out of prison in the late 80s. Back pay, would you say, for the time that he had been gone. So would you say it's accurate to say that Joe Mack came out of retirement to do this Jimmy Sims things? He wasn't like part of his day-to-day life anymore.
One thing that I heard again and again, including from John Matarano and several others, is that Joe Mack had exemplary energy for an older guy. The guy, he talked fast, he moved fast, he was always thinking about a scheme, things like this. But he's pushing 70 in 92. Now, I think he was still pretty active. He was in low, he got out of prison. He did a lot of time in a Terre Haute federal penitentiary after the machine guns with the whole Whitey thing that happened in 82 when he got caught. And he did.
We're going to go backwards. Yeah. And then, yeah. So sure. We're going to hit sure. on that.
Yep. So he gets out late 86, early 87. By 88, 89, he's up in Lowell. And he's trying to shore things up in there. He's trying to take over the booking and the loan shark and up in Lowell.
So there was no retirement. I somehow.
Eventually. No, you got it right. But it was later because he was pretty. I mean, obviously, in prison, he was pretty sober. He probably was getting some scotch here and there, but he was pretty much sober. When he come out, he was going to AA with some guys that I talked to, a figure prominently in the book and the beginning and in the end, and they were keeping him relatively sober for quite a few years after he got out of the can. But after that happened in 92, he had to kill his best friend, and it was the 50th anniversary of the sinking of the USS Quincy in 1942. And not only that, which was on his mind, and that's when he lost his brother. And not only that, but they also found the USS Quincy, and that was on Travel Channel. It was on TBS in 19, I think it was aired in 1992. So all this has happened at once. And then Joe took a dive in the bottle and didn't come out. So after that, after 92, 93, 94, 95, the alcoholism took over.
But it wasn't necessarily a scenario where he tapped out when he came out of prison and got that money from Whitey. He was still, even though he was running the boxing gym, he was still doing dirt to an extent until he falls back into the bottle.
Well, he was he was giving money to boxing gyms. He was supporting them, okay. And he was doing that through most of his life. He was a big time boxing fan, and also kind of an amateur champion in his own right in Boston, but. Yeah, in the eight, when he got out of prison, especially and into the 90s, he was given money. Actually, when he was a fugitive as well, he would give a lot of money every year to gyms in Southie and Somerville, but he wasn't running it himself. He was involved, and he'd go all the fights and everything else and show up. Matter of fact, that's where I saw him. When I was a kid in Somerville, he was at an amateur boxing card in Somerville at Anthony's, actually.
So let's. I'm sorry that I confused some of these facts. I'm still learning. I'm nowhere near an expert on Joe Mack. So I'm still learning the.
Nobody is. Don't worry about it. Nobody.
The contours.
Yeah.
So let's just go back and talk about Joe Mack, his youth, and his time in the military, surviving the sinking of a submarine, losing his brother, and then getting back into Boston area and becoming this, you know, legendary racketeer. Tell us that story.
Well, the book, I start the book off not with, you know, with the cradle. I don't start the book off with that. Chapter one starts with him floating around in the South Pacific.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. It sets the scene perfect.
Because that's where really his anti-life, if you will, began. Because he's 25 years old on that night. It was August 9th, 1942. And he's 25 years old. He had just lost his little brother. His little brother's name was Jackie, John Francis McDonald. John Francis McDonald aspired to be a police officer. He was like a Boy Scout. He was probably the favorite of the four boys of the mother. All-American boy, very patriotic. But as it was, in early December 1941, he joined the Naval Reserves. This was before Pearl Harbor. He had to get permission from mom because he was underage. So then Pearl Harbor happens just a few days later. Mom was beside herself. She goes to Joe. Joe's the second oldest boy, but he's kind of the one. He's a strong one. Not a criminal. He wasn't a criminal. He was a man about town. You know, he was popular with the women. He had a job. He had a car. He was doing okay for himself. Mom pulls him and says, "I need you to bring Jackie home safe." He joins the Naval Reserves. Why? Bring Jackie home safe.
Protect his brother.
To protect his brother. So they end up on the same ship, which this was before the Sullivan brothers and all that. That could happen. So he was on the USS Quincy, which, by the way, was called the hometown ship because it was built just outside of Boston, in the Quincy shipyards. So they're on the ship together. Now, I got the military records. They're this thick. And of both of them, John Francis, Jackie McDonald, and Joe McDonald. And Joe is well-behaved. There's no court martials. He's getting high grades. He's working hard. He's with his brother. He's modeling how to be a man for his brother. They're in the South Pacific and Savo Sound, floating around. This is right for Guadalcanal. And they, it's the dead of night. It's a hot night. Everything's quiet. There were some mistakes made because a Japanese fleet snuck into the sound. They just quietly got into the sound. They were well-trained in night attacks. The United States was not trained in night attacks at this point. We learned fast, but at this point, they were not trained in it. So torpedoes hit the USS Quincy, as well as two other ships, at least. And in 35 minutes, that ship was on its way down. Joe, of course, is frantically looking for his brother. At some point, he finds him. My understanding is that he had his arm around him, and they're trying to find a way off the ship and, you know, to safety. When shrapnel flies, now keep in mind the scene. This is pure chaos. There are fires. There are screaming. There are limbs flying. You know, the sky is being lit up by the attacks from the Japanese. Shrapnel is hurling through the air and takes off his brother's head. The body collapses and then tumbles over the side of the ship and into the black deep. Joe, half out of his mind, dives in after the body. Whose voice is echoing in his head? His mother's voice. So he dives in. Now, by the light of the fire of the sinking ship, he sees sharks take the body under.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's what he had to cope with. Now he's out there. There are other sailors, too, and they're floating around in Savo Sound. The ship goes down. The Japanese leave. It's like a deadly calm. This is worse than Jaws because you can't see a thing. And there's a slight drizzle at times, spotty drizzle at times. And Joe Mack. Now, Joe Mack's not going to talk about this. But when he's on his benders, he would let loose some details, and that's how you can piece it together. And especially to told family members who told me, big things were bumping his legs all night. Those are sharks.
Oh, my God.
So I did some research and I found that, first of all, the Navy uniforms, it was like a, you know, you could float in them too. And they had, and it was a knife that you had as well. So according to one report I got, Joe killed 11 sharks that night. According to another report I have, Joe killed about 22 sharks that night. Yeah. But that's going to do so. He's out there for about 5 hours. Dawn comes, here come the rescue ships, and they're pulling him out of the drink. My premise in the book is that the man who sailed into Savo Sound was not the man who was pulled out of Savo Sound the next morning. Just right. Not. So what does he do? He could have gone home. He could have claimed any number of psychological traumas and gone home. But what happens? He's in there until the end. So he's in there from 41 to 45. He's in there for the extent of it. It almost looks like revenge. And matter of fact, I have a military in his records. There's a sheet where you, in the event of a sinking of a ship being sunk, you know, what you lost, you can get it replaced. Everything's gone on Joe's. He's got whatever he has is what he wore. His socks, his pants, his shirt, his hat's gone. You know, everything's gone. So, but nevertheless, Joe stays in the war. So that's what happened. And, you know, and he's, so when he comes out now, when he comes out, he's looking for his girlfriend. And this is a whole, this story reads it. There's a lot of different kind of subplots in the story.
A lot of emotion, a lot of like the color, like the different, the palette that you're painting from. The brush has so many different colors, and that's what makes the best stories, right? Like you think somebody's one dimensional, and you learn that they're not so black and white. There's 1,000 different hues.
Yeah, well said. And one thing that was on my mind when I was writing this book was I don't want it to look like, you know, the DC and Marvel superhero movies where they have 14 different storylines going at once and nobody cares. So I had to be careful with how I, you know, how I moved it along. But one of the things that had happened before he went to war, he met a green-eyed, beautiful woman named Florence. And then this happened with Jackie, where he went to war, so he followed. So he basically kissed his girlfriend goodbye and says, you know, I got to go to war. She felt abandoned, but he thinks she's going to wait for him. She doesn't wait for him. She gets married to an Italian peddler. The son of an Italian immigrant fruit peddlers, and he's an artist. He didn't know this. At least at first, he didn't know that she got married, but she was pregnant when he left to war with Joe's child. So the child was born while he was overseas, and the man she married thought it was his daughter. So there's all kinds of family stuff going on here. So I'm, you know, trying to help the reader to understand, you know, what this man was about and what was really happening around him as well. So when he comes out and he comes stateside, he goes looking for Flo. Flo's married. Guess what? Joe's a different man now. There's a brutality about him. There's a threat that emanates from him. And in no time at all, she divorces him, or he divorces her, actually, and marries him. So now he's a family man. But all I can think about was the old film noirs. I love film noirs.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, what they have, the storyline is World War II vet sees trauma in the war, becomes marred, comes home, and now he's a ticking time bomb. And that's Joe. That's Joe Mack. That's why the third chapter is called Joe Noir, because right. He comes home, and this is a dangerous individual. He's brilliant. He's got principles. He used to be, he had the makings of a very productive citizen, but something happened along the way, and now you have something different, something that's more shadow than light that comes home.
And how does he link up with Buddy McClain? And basically, from that point, they're the founders of what becomes the Irish mob in Boston.
Well, what happens is Buddy McClain's a very interesting story, because Joe, for the rest of his life, he becomes something of a mentor for younger, mostly Irish men. Who are they? They're Jackies.
Right.
They're the brother he lost. And Buddy was the first of them. Buddy had a baby face, real tough guy. You know, was into boxing. Joe was into boxing as well. Joe taught him how to box, you know, taught him how to kind of streamline his street fighting skills, and they become close. Buddy McClain, though, he's not what Joe was. He's more of a citizen. He's more of a civilian than Joe. I think it was Joe who founded what became the Winter Hill Gang out of Somerville. I think it was Joe, and what I was told by a lot of guys who know, is that Joe really was the beginning of organized crime in Somerville. Somerville was a working class city just outside of Boston, still is. Now it's more yuppified, but back then it was a rough place. And, you know, a lot of street gangs and things like that. And then it would graduate into the rackets. But it was really Joe who was instrumental in streamlining and organizing those rackets. So in the 50s, he's a family man, but he's out all night because he's putting things together. He got arrested a few times, beat all the cases. So he's in the shadows. He's also already become very much feared. In Somerville and around Somerville. Boston's right there. So, you know, it's the same difference in that anybody who was a part of the underworld in the 50s understood that Joe Mack is not someone you want to cross. So, but he's doing his own thing, you know, for right through the 50s. Matter of fact, I found out later that there was some disturbances on the Boston waterfront. Now, I wrote something for City Journal called On the Boston Waterfront. And it's about a longshoreman from South Boston, Irish, an ex-professional boxer named Tommy Sullivan. And he was killed in 1957, just steps from his door of his house on East 5th Street in South Boston. And he, over the next 10 years, developed a reputation as being, you know, part of organized crime. But I found out he was not at all. He was kind of a hero in the neighborhood. Matter of fact, I have a letter from Whitey Bulger. Whitey Bulger says Tommy Sullivan was a hero in South Boston and not involved with crime at all. Whitey Bulger's given him, you know, that kind of glory as a superhero type of figure. But what was going on was that New York was making inroads or trying to make inroads onto the Boston waterfront to take over the rackets there. It was very lucrative. And they were going through the McLaughlin Gang. The McLaughlin Gang were out of Charlestown. Charlestown's a neighborhood in Boston, right on the border of Somerville. And so New York is trying to use them as kind of a vanguard to take over the Boston waterfronts. What New York didn't realize is that Boston is Boston. You don't invade Boston. Everybody rises up. You know, it's not the place to do something like that. So now in the story of the Boston waterfront, after Tommy Sullivan died, it's almost like, you know, Charlestown, Somerville got together. The guys on the waterfront, they rose up. They fought off the New York gangsters making moves. I thought that's what happened. I found out when I was writing this book that there's another X factor in here. That X factor is Joe Mack. And what I was told, this I could not quite chase it down. It's almost like a whisper in the wind. But what I was told is that there were three guys from New York, and they were affiliated with the Genovese family. And what happened was Joe, according to these sources, set up a meeting with them in New York. First, he had to get an okay in New York, set up a meeting and killed all three of them. And that's why the disturbances in the Boston waterfront and New York's making inroads.
Calm down.
Right. So the whisper is that Joe Mack went and killed all three of them, you know, in 19, you know, late 50s somewhere. So fascinating stuff. But I was able to make some connections, and I put those mostly in the notes of the book. It's too much of a detour, but you can see the lines. You can see how this very well could have happened.
And he is front and center when all the violence pops off in the 60s and 70s. Can you talk a little bit about the two of the most famous hits from that period, Punchy McLaughlin and Spike O'Toole?
Well, Joe was, I call him the boogeyman of the so-called Irish gang war. Back then it was really called in the papers and whatnot. It was called the Gangland War, the Boston Gangland War. And that was really something else. That was because tensions exploded between the McLaughlin gang in Charlestown. And what was my understanding was already was an organization already called The Hill in Somerville. People in Somerville, especially during the time, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, Winter Hill was not called Winter Hill so much. It was called The Hill.
The Hill.
Yeah. But really, they were, you know, they were a lot of tough guys, but they did not have the power of the McLaughlin gang at this point. McLaughlin gang still believed they had New York behind them as well. They had a lot of connections out there. They would go back and forth to New York City and to Charlestown. So what happened was, you know, I think it is true. The famous sexual assault on somebody's girlfriend, you know, up in Salisbury Beach.
It was, wasn't it Bobo?
It was Alex Rocco's girlfriend.
Right, a.k.a.
Mo Green.
Mo Green, a.k.a. Joe Polnicek's dad on Facts of Life. That's how I got introduced to him before I ever watched The Godfather. It was Joe from Facts of Life's ex-felon dad.
Well, I first saw him without even realizing it when I was a kid watching the old Adam West Batman reruns. He was thug number two.
Right.
And, and that was his breakout. Well, not his breakout role, but that was his first role in Hollywood. Basically, he was sent out west to save his life by Buddy McClain. Because after Georgie McLaughlin, who was a psychopath, after he assaulted it looks like Bobo Petricone's girlfriend or Alex Rocco's girlfriend. He got hurt badly. I mean, especially back then in working class Boston, you're going to assault or even insult someone's girlfriend or wife. You're going to get a beating. There's no warning. You're just going to get a beating. Not necessarily going to get killed, but you're going to get a beating. He got a beating. They thought he was dead. They left him there. Now, some of the books have a different story. I think I got the truth. I thought the guys were very much closer to the action. They left him there outside of a club. And he was in the hospital for several days and then got out. And his brothers, Bernie McLaughlin and Punchy McLaughlin, Punchy being an ex-boxer, who was kind of the leader of the group, they demanded revenge. So they go to Somerville and they sit down with Buddy McClain. They said, you know, we want blood for blood. But they wanted somebody to get, they wanted the guys involved to get killed. They wanted murder. Buddy says, that sounds like Vito Corleone. That's not justice. Your daughter still lives.
Yeah. Right.
So what they did.
Great impression, Buddy, by the way. Very, very, very on point.
Thank you. So but Buddy says, listen, you know, the guys who hurt your brother, I'll give them the same beating and then some. But there's no murder here. We're not going to kill him. Everything. They came to some kind of a truce, according to Maxie Shackelford, who was there. They came to some kind of a truce. But what happens? They later try to blow up Buddy's car, the family car that his wife used and his kids were in going to school. So now things get bad. And what happens? Buddy McClain shoots Bernie McLaughlin in the head in Charlestown with about 100 witnesses, mostly longshoremen, none of whom saw a thing. And then it was on. But now that was 61. There's a lull. So a lot of these organized crime historians think there was a lull because, well, it wasn't really about that, you know. No, because everybody went to prison. Everybody went to jail. They got picked up off the streets because, you know, the police are involved, the DA's involved. So they plucked, including Buddy McClain, getting plucked off the streets on, you know, on whatever count. So there was a lull. Meanwhile, Joe is in prison for armed robbery. He's looking at 12 years. But Buddy's now in jeopardy. Buddy McClain's in jeopardy because again, the McLaughlin gang is gunning for him. So what does he do? He escapes. Why does he escape? To protect his friend. He doesn't want to relive the trauma he had with his little brother Jackie on the USS Quincy in Savo Sound. He escapes. And he's there to protect Buddy. So the violence was ridiculous. It was chaos. There were bodies in Brookline, Boston, all over the place. Matter of fact, that the headlines are pretty funny. The war really took off very soon after the last Boston strangling. So the timing was something, and the headlines were perfect. One of them said, Gangland War makes Boston stranglings look like, Gangland War makes Boston Massacre look like church picnic. So this was, this was something that was outlandish. And it was happening right and left. And it wasn't just Irish. It was Italian guys involved, Jewish guys involved, French Canadians. So it ran the gamut.
In terms of ending the war, is it accurate to say that when Joe Mack kills Spike O'Toole, that's the end of it in 73?
That was a fume. The end of it really was the death of the Hughes brothers. You know, they were allied with the McLaughlin brothers. Georgie was picked up and was in prison. I think it was 66. Yeah, 65, 66. He went into prison, and that was it for him. Punchy was killed at a bus stop in West Roxbury in 65. Yep. Soon after that, Buddy McLaughlin was killed in Somerville, right on off of Broadway. And that was very traumatic for Joe. And I think that's after that, Joe himself went after the Hughes brothers. And I think he probably got both of them. I think he definitely got Connie. So it looks like he ended it with Spike O'Toole. That was later. That was in 73, December of 73. Yeah. And there's a lot of different ideas as to who killed him, but it was Tommy King who shot him up with a semi-automatic. And then Joe McDonald, now he's getting up there in age now. He's well over 50. You know, he gets out of the car, walks over to a barely breathing Spike O'Toole, lifts up his mask just so Spike O'Toole could see who it was, and then finished off the last of the McLaughlin gangs.
And what he makes a comment, right, after he shoots him.
What was this?
I thought he was just saying, like, you won't be hearing from him no more. We don't got no problems with them no more. Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, something, yeah, yeah. Joe didn't say much, but he did tell some stories. He had one. And I tried to chase down too, but I couldn't. But I heard from a guy who was very close to him. He said that Joe was in Charlestown. This is during the war. Shouldn't have been in Charlestown. But there he was, probably in a disguise, knowing Joe. He's in Charlestown, and he saw one of the McLaughlin allies come out of a bar. And so he walks up to him. The guy sees him. The guy goes for his gun. Joe's gun was already out. Joe says, I shot him in the head, then I shot him up the ass. You know. So I'm looking for, you know, anybody gets shot up the rear, you know, in all the Boston Herald and the, you know, Boston Globe. I couldn't find it, though.
Let's jump from it. And just to finish off something you said, Spike O'Toole was killed December 1st, 73, outside of a hotel in Dorchester.
Outside of a bar.
Bar, sorry.
Yep.
Let's go from the violence to more of the, I guess, velvet-gloved gangster that Joe Mack was. And let's talk about the stamp robbery. Him and Jimmy Sims in 1971 get about $500,000 of worth of stamps.
Yeah, rare stamps. Yeah.
Can you talk about that? And then eventually that leads to Joe Mack having to kill one of his fences.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Joe had his hand in a lot of things. I mean, he was a killer, and I think he was also a hitman for hire as well. But my understanding is that he was careful about who he killed. In other words, he had some kind of a code. He wasn't like Whitey Bulger. I don't think he was a sadist that Whitey Bulger was. He wouldn't kill women. He didn't kill kids. There's definitely some questionable murders that he did, like John Larry. That's an ugly one. He was just a criminal. He was a career criminal. A lot of the guys in the Boston underworld, they were part-time criminals. They worked all day. They were longshoremen. They were roofers. They were painters. You know, they worked on the docks. Some were policemen. And then at night or part-time, they would do things. You know, they would do all kinds of crimes and all that. But a lot of them had full-time jobs. Then you got the guys like Joe. Joe was a professional criminal. He hit a rare stamp business in Beacon Hill, and how he did it was brazen but also brilliant in his own way. Him and Jimmy Sims put on masks, said they were delivery men or something like that, buzzed their way into this business on Beacon Hill. And when they got upstairs, they tied everybody up. They pulled out the gun. They tied everybody up and they took all the stamps. By some estimates, it was $500,000 worth of rare stamps. Some say it was $1 million worth of rare stamps. So now they have to get a fence. So they got to get rare stamp experts. So they got one local and they want to get as far away from Boston as they can. So there's one individual, he was a civilian, a good citizen. His name was Raymond Lundgren. And he offered to buy the stamps, not for his collection necessarily, but to sell them and make some good money. So he would come up.
He's in LA, right? He's in LA.
Sierra Madre, but his business is in LA. Yeah.
Okay. And Sierra Madre is like in the San Gabriel Valley, I think.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And you know, this guy's a father. He looks like a history teacher in the fifth grade. You know, he's kind of a real civilian type. And it surprised me just looking at him why he would get involved with these characters. So he comes up and he's actually driving around with Joe Mack, and Joe Mack's, you know, being civil with him and trying to reassure him that this is a very safe thing to do and this and that. But Joe Mack come across as very friendly, you know, very much of a charismatic individual. And I heard this from a lot of people. Well, Raymond Lundgren was not afraid enough of Joe Mack and Jimmy Sims. So the FBI got wind of it. It's a long story as to how, but the FBI got wind of what happened and they pulled Raymond Lundgren in, and Raymond Lundgren flipped like a pancake. I mean, in no time at all. And unfortunately for Lundgren, Joe Mack found out in no time at all. So him and Sim drive out there. They drive out to Sierra Madre. And Sims stays in the car up the street. Joe Mack gets out. He has maybe a handkerchief over his face, if that, maybe even his hand. And he goes into the garage of the condominium that Lundgren shared with his wife. They pull in same time every day after work. And Joe Mack's in the shadows and he shoots him 5 times in front of his wife. And then he leaves. But it was, that was something that brought a lot of heat down because that's a federal witness now. Right. So the FBI was frantic to get to him. And, you know, and what was funny in looking at all the Freedom of Information Act documents and a lot of court files that I was able to find with notes from the U.S. Attorney's Office and this and that was when they were trying to get to informants, the moment they said Joe Mack's name or Jimmy Sims' name, the informant just walked away. They just turn on their heels and walk away. They want nothing to do with those two. So that was in 1976.
And the both of them at that point are fugitives, correct?
Joe Mack was laying low because of the rare stamp, that robbery, as was Sims. They were laying low. They weren't necessarily, they didn't put it to the wind yet. But on April 1st, 1976, Joe Mack's face is all over the 6 o'clock news, all around Boston and everywhere else. He's now on the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives list. So he's all over the place. Now he goes to into the wind. And Sims does too.
And this is where some of our research dovetailed, and there are a couple more things I want to touch on before we wrap this up. I'm having such a great time here. I know we're going to go a little longer than most of our episodes, but I'm excited about that. So Winter Hill gets involved in a horse fixing conspiracy with one of their Italian members, Tony Chula, Fat Tony the Fixer, and he flips in Detroit, which is where I'm from. And for a couple of years in the late 70s, Tony Chula had come into the Detroit area, Hazel Park Racetrack, which was run by the Mafia since it began. And Chula and a lot of those Boston guys came into Detroit and set up shop for an extended period of time. They were running stuff out of a bar called Derby's, which was right outside of the racetrack. And then Detroit FBI nails Chula and he flips almost immediately. And I know the agents personally that did this case. And they are, to this day, very angry and feel betrayed that the bust that Joe Mack was included in, Jimmy Sims was included in, Whitey Bulger was not, or he skated in this because of his cooperation deal that nobody knew about. And the guys that I have been able to get them to tell their story, and in my first book, Motor City Mafia, I think I give a pretty good breakdown of what was going on with Tony Chula in Detroit. But these Detroit FBI agents are like, in their mind, and I want to get your opinion on this, in their mind, if everything was on the level, and I know this is a little bit of an aside to Joe Mack, but Joe Mack mm-hmm. was in that case. Mm-hmm. That they believe if the FBI would have been doing their job, and Whitey would have gone down in the case like he should have, you wouldn't have had all the chaos that he caused in the 80s and 90s.
There's no doubt about it. First of all, I should say that Joe Mack hated Whitey Bulger, despised him, didn't respect him, thought he was a phony, didn't take him very seriously. And Whitey and Fleming in that case were considered unindicted
co-conspirators.
Right. Now, so it's a very interesting case because Joe Mack did not like overcomplicated schemes like that. He's the guy that gets a handkerchief, goes like this, and takes everything you've got. He bluffs his way into your business, takes everything you got. He's almost straightforward like that, brazen and brilliant in his own way. But these sophisticated schemes that involved a lot of people, he shied away from. You know, don't talk about Joe Mack. You don't want a lot of people looking at your face. So in that case, he's really, from the Winter Hill side, he's kind of the heavy. He's the one threatening the jockeys. You're going to pull back or else. He's also the guy that supplies money for bribes. That's his role. And of course, he gets his cut. But that case is really the end of the hill as we know it. After that, see, and Whitey Bulger and Fleming, the fact that they were, and Joe wanted to kill him over that. Joe saw the writing on the wall. Joe wanted to kill them both after that. He was restrained by Howie Winter, who was the face of the hill, because it'd be just hell to pay if they didn't. I think Howie was probably right. But it's fun to think about if Joe killed Whitey at that point, a lot of people would have been spared a lot of misery. So what happened was, Howie went away. Well, Howie was already in legal trouble, but he got indicted for that. This was 79.
The bus comes. Yeah, the bus exactly. Comes on Chula in 79.
Yeah. The indictments came down in February. I remember that. And the whole thing started in 73. It's about 6 years. It's a lot of money. And there was vats of cash coming into the garage on Winter Hill and was being divvied up for the partners. It's a lot of money. You know, they had a very good system.
And they were going city to city. They didn't hit Detroit until like 70. Detroit was the stop where they got busted. And they were there like 77, 78.
Yeah, right. So there's a ton of money, most of which Joe's cut ended up in his walls, I think. So what happened was the hill was really taken apart because they were doing hard time. Now, Joe, luckily for him, and Sims were already on the lam. They were already down in Florida. Materano soon joined them. But the only two active partners now in Massachusetts is Whitey and Fleming. Now, people say that Whitey Bulger was not Winter Hill. Well, he was a partner. Was he in Marshall Motors garage without Howie and Joe and everybody else? Nah, I'm told that he was kind of chased out of there, and that's why he went to the Lancaster garage,
right?
Yeah, over in the North End. Somerville did not look at Whitey like Southie looked at Whitey at the time. You know, there were much more serious guys in the hill than Whitey. Whitey was very powerful because of his connections. So you had to be careful with him. But they were much more dangerous guys. Joe, Sims, Howe. I mean, they're all more dangerous than Whitey. No, but Whitey was, I think, just a little bit of an aside. Whitey was a little bit sadistic. you know, and he didn't have the kind of code that a lot of the other guys have, especially Joe was about 20 years older than everybody else. He was, you know, very dangerous, very brilliant, read a lot of books, very brilliant guy, but he had people off balance because of, you know, what he did and how he did it. You know, for instance, you know, the Deborah Davis murder.
Wade was a predator. And I think that sometimes gets overshadowed by his being a big bad gangster confidential informant, but yeah, he was more than just a mobster and a gangster. He was somebody that preyed on little boys and girls, and I think that unfortunately is not a part of the legacy of him that it should be, because it was more than just being an Irish mob boss and being a confidential informant. I mean, he was ruining lives at a much lower level than just, not lower level, but different level.
Well, I'll tell you this. Every time there was a confrontation between Joe Mack and Whitey Bulger, Whitey wanted no part of Joe Mack, and it was Whitey that always gave ground. Joe Mack was really the guy. But like I said, Whitey Bulger, there was very much that was unsettling about him. You know, so, but like I said, Joe wanted to kill him at least three times. But nevertheless, because of, Whitey moved in the shadows against his partners in the Hill and then took them apart. So you got to hand it to him. So now he's basically, so to speak, the last partner with Flemmy. And Flemmy's kind of a junior partner. But this process that Whitey did with clearing the field of his rivals began in, you know, back in 75. When he took out his main rivals in South, he had them killed, a guy named Buddy Leonard and Tommy King. That was kind of that was a dress rehearsal for what happened later, you know, in 79. But he did it smoother. There was no bloodshed. He saw them indicted. And he's the last man standing with Flemmy. So, and Joe, where's Joe? He's down in Florida. He's on the run. He's on the news for crying out loud. He's on the run. They're looking for him high and low. So it's an interesting thing how that happened. But that's the case that really broke apart the Hill.
And now tell people that how Joe Mack got caught. He got Whitey Bulger gave him up.
That's what it looks like. Yeah. And this was very tough to find. But the word on the street, I talked to about 30 guys who you know, were part of that life. Most of them are very serious. And what they said, almost to a man, is that the reason why Joe was arrested with those machine guns at Penn Station, September of 82, is because of Whitey. But they didn't, I said, well, give me details. They don't have any details. They just said, I know Whitey did it. I don't think they were withholding either. You know how it was done. So then I heard this this name, and I got it from John Matarano. And he said there was a guy named Gus Meany, who Joe hooked up with in Florida when he was on the lam down there in the late 70s and early 80s. And so I'm looking everywhere for a guy named Gus, last name Meany. And it took me about a month. And by accident, I find out that the guy's Italian and his last name is Gus Meany. So now I can find him. What I found out is that Vernon Gus Meany was connected to Whitey up here. It's a long story how, but he was connected to Whitey up here. And Whitey, one point he took him for a ride. And Whitey had an ice pick. And he's sticking him in the arm with the ice pick, making threats. Gus Meany fears for his life. So what happens after then, you could put together. Gus Meany is doing Whitey's bidding, trying to extort money in Whitey's name up around Boston. And he ends up in Florida within the year. And he hooks up with Joe Mack. Whitey feared Joe Mack, hated Joe Mack. And he had to pay Joe Mack fugitive funds, because that's the agreement in the Hill. Because you're on the run, you're getting $1,000, $500 a week, $1,000 a week from Whitey. So fast forward, and we have Joe being driven to a train station in Hollywood, Florida by Gus Meany. He's got a big gym bag. In the gym bag are three machine guns taken apart with homemade silencers and ammunition. He gets on the train. Cops are at the train station. They try to stop him to check his bag. Joe knows the law, get lost. He's on the train. He goes to Penn Station. Police are waiting for him up there. You know, so Gus Meany is the link. You got Whitey in the shadows. Joe's not the kind of guy that gets caught. He's very, very good at being a fugitive. And now he's caught with three machine guns. one-way ticket. Some people think he was going to kill Whitey with the machine guns. Not sure I buy that, but he got caught, and his long, long run was over, as you know, on the FBI's top 10.
And what, you know, as we're wrapping up here, what is your research tell you about what Joe Mack's take on what happened to what? I mean, he was there for when Whitey was exposed. He died in 97. I understand that he was kind of hiding in a bottle, you know, probably not thinking as straight as he would have been without being, you know, drinking as much at the end. But he knew that Whitey had been kind of this giant fraud by that point, right? 97, he's kind of outed in, and the Globe outed him in 88. I think outed him again in 97. Maybe Joe Mack died before that second outing. But do you know what Joe's take on Whitey was at the end?
I think Joe would probably, you know, relieved that he was getting so much attention, because that's less attention for Joe.
Right.
But one of the things that happened towards the end, this is, well, it's actually probably 89. Whitey Bulger owed Joe a lot of money, and he wasn't paying him, which raises an eyebrow, because that's not, you don't do that to a guy like Joe. So what happened was, Joe was talking to Jackie Mansfield and Jimmy Sims at the paddock over in Somerville on the opposite end of this Marshall Street from the garage. And he says, I'm going to go see the bald guy. He called Whitey Bulger the bald guy, which I found funny because Joe's bald. According to guys who knew both of them, they said that, well, Joe knew that Whitey was vain, and Joe was not vain at all. So he called Whitey the bald guy. Well, he says, I'm going to go see the bald guy at the liquor store and get my money. So both guys stand up. We're going with you. They knew Whitey was dangerous. And Joe says, no, I do this alone. I think he said, I do this alone, because he might have killed him, and he didn't want them getting, you know, caught up in all that. So he goes to South Boston Liquors in the Rotary there, and he walks in. And he says to the guy behind the desk, he says, I'm looking for the bald guy. And the guy behind the desk probably had instructions. Oh, he's not here. Sorry. You know who I am? Yeah, I know who you are. You're Joe Mack. All right. You tell Whitey that I'm going to be back here in 1 hour. And if he doesn't have the money he owes me, I'm going to kill him and Flemmy both. And then he leaves. Now, it gets very interesting here, because I found out by a DEA agent that that was taped. The DEA was taping. They had a bug in the South Boston liquor store, and that was picked up. I tried to get the tape. I couldn't. But according to what I know and what I've heard, that's what was said. So what happens in an hour? Suitcases were delivered to Joe's house by Fleming, and they were filled with money he was owed. He didn't cross that man, you know.
This is so good. This, please, everybody, I'm imploring you, go get this book. If you're a fan of true crime and organized, even if you don't know anything about the Irish mob or the Boston mob, please go pick this book up. Don't Talk About Joe Mack. This is a, in terms of the Irish mob, this is a Bible. And the Irish mob in Boston, this is the best book I think ever written on the subject. All due respect to Howie, all due respect to O'Neill and Lehrer. They did great jobs, but to me, this takes the cake.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
And I just want to throw one more thing out there that your reporting kind of dovetailed with some of my reporting. And I mentioned this to you off camera, but I just want to tell the audience. My audience knows, if they've been following me for a while, that for a short period of time, I was with Cadillac Frank Salemi. And we were working on his biography, his autobiography, in the months before they found Stevie DeSaro. And he called me one Sunday. I can remember it very vividly. I was watching the Lions, and he called me and said, you know, Scott, I appreciate everything these last couple of months. And I'm dropping out. And he had been so gung-ho. This is going to wrap back around to Joe McDowell in a second. I'm sorry. He had been very hot to trot, and then something spooked him, and I found out shortly thereafter that it was, he had gotten word, I'm sure, that they were going to dig up a body and he was going to be pulled out of witness protection and the life that he knew it was over with. But in some of our interviews, what happened to Jimmy Sims was discussed. And Frank, in 1992, Cadillac Frank was the boss of the New England La Cosa Nostra. And he seemed pretty confident in telling me that Joe McDonald had killed Jimmy Sims. He didn't know anything else in terms of how it happened or where it happened. He didn't say that he knew that because of any firsthand information. He just kind of said, like, from what I know about Joe Mac, that's probably what happened to Jimmy Sims. And I didn't think about it. So that was 2015. I didn't think about it for almost 10 years, or over 10 years, until I
two things
a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's interesting to me. That's good to know, because, well, there's two things that come to mind. One is that no one's going to hurt Jimmy Sims and survive, because Joe was very close to him, and he was, in that sense, Sims is untouchable. So the fact that Jimmy Sims disappeared, well, there's only one guy that's going to make him disappear. There's that. But the other thing is that it was an act of friendship, and that's what I try to portray in that chapter. And that's, you know, all the research I did and all the guys I talked to, Joe Mac is not going to kill his friend for an idle reason. The gist of it, and I'm giving away a little bit, and this is a best part of the book, but the gist of it is this: had Joe Mac not killed Jimmy Sims, and he did it immediately, Jimmy Sims never knew what happened. You know, he blinked and then there's St. Peter. That's how fast it was. Had Joe Mac not done that, New York would have taken 4 days to kill him. So it was an act of friendship in that sense.
My gut tells me, and this is me kind of going on my instinct, I don't think that Cadillac Frank knew exactly what happened, but I believe that Cadillac, after reading your book and knowing that there were things that Cadillac Frank wasn't telling me, I mean, he'd only known me for a couple months. I mean, we were just getting to know each other. So I think he knew about the debt. I think
everybody did. Yeah. The debts. Yeah. Yeah, plural. Right. Yeah.
I think he knew about the situation that led to Jimmy Sims disappearing. I don't think he knew exactly what happened, but I think he did the math in his head and tells me that Joe Mac did it without telling me. This other scenario that you bring out is that he had made this big bet in New York and the New York guys were upset.
This is how smart Joe was. Joe didn't use anybody in Somerville. He didn't use any of the partners to take out Jimmy Sims. He went elsewhere and he got guys who are as closed mouthed as him and damn near as dangerous. You know, these guys are very serious guys. They're from the lower end of South Boston, not Whitey territory. They weren't. And that's what he did. So that also was compartmentalized. And that's how Joe, you know, was able to do this stuff. Nobody knew what was going on. I mean, his closest friends had no idea what happened. Matter of fact, I had to tell Jackie Mansfield that, because he was hurt that he didn't know. I said, Jackie, I said, you're best friends with Joe and Sims. Joe wanted to keep you as a friend. How would you have felt if you had found out in 92 that Joe had killed Sims? You would have distanced yourself. He didn't want that. So he had to keep it from you in that sense. Do you remember remember the movie Usual Suspects?
Yeah, of course.
For me, a disappointment in that movie was that Kaiser Soze wasn't real. Well, after this book, yeah, he was.
Yes, exactly. Great way to conclude. You've done it all. You've said it all. This has been one of my favorite pod interviews in our 6 years of existence, where from when we were just audio to now when we're audio and video. Springs, tell everybody where they can get the book and get other books of yours and consume the content.
Well, go to Amazon, get it there. And if you like it, if you really like it, like 5 stars worth, give me 5 stars, that helps. And review if you feel so inclined, all that helps, you know. So Amazon first. You can also go to my website, springsolito.com. You can see features that I've written for the City Journal that came out of the research, but are not in the book. So I'm out there. But yeah, Amazon is also available at Bloomsbury, Barnes & Noble. I'm going to be doing some events, but mostly around Boston. It's not quite worth it for me to go traveling all around with the book. Mm-hmm. I wish I could go to New York City, but that doesn't make a lot of financial sense. So Amazon's the way to go for me.
Well, this was awesome. Hopefully I'll maybe get to see you in person. I'm going to be in town later this year. My whole mom's side of the family is from Boston. So I spent, I'm in my late 40s now. I've been going to Boston since the late 70s, early 80s. I love it. It's a second home. So we'll link up for a drink, brother.
Absolutely. I'll be there.
Well, thank you so much. This was unbelievable. Everybody go get Don't Talk About Joe Mack. This is the Bible. If you want to know about the Irish mob in Boston and the legacy and legend of Joe Mack, go pick up the book, learn yourself some stuff, put some money in Spring's pocket, spread the word about what a great journalist he is and a great author and historian he is, chronicling the just riveting Boston underworld. Thank you so much, Springs. Enjoy your weekend. Stay warm, stay cool. I'm out west, headed back home into the Midwest shortly, but I've been in 100 degree heat out west the last couple of weeks. So
you can have that.
Yeah. Okay, everybody, please like, share, and subscribe. Original Gangsters News Network and Podcast for Benny, my producer. Thank you for Springs. Thank you so much for joining us. You are always welcome back. I hope everybody enjoyed this. Original Gangsters News Network, uncovering the underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. We're out.